All right, 7 o'clock, time to go. Well, it looks like we lost part of the group on this side. Maybe I should have showed more pictures last week. Well, good, yeah. Gained a few, that's all right. Always want to have more. Whenever I see a picture, there's a story to be told. So I can't show you a lot of pictures because a lot of stories we'd miss. So I get bogged down. I was going to get a lot further than I did, and I made an executive decision. We have 5 lessons left after today. 5 lessons left. There's no way. No way we can do all of the stuff we need to do in 5 lessons. It would kill me if I tried to do it, because it means I get all the material together and pick out all that material, 5 lessons. So we're going to plot along. I hope it's not plotting to you, but we're going to take it as it comes. And we get down to May, we'll quit. And if I can't figure anything else for next fall, we'll just pick up in September and keep on going. So, yeah, you like that? All right. No, listen, I'm going to teach you the Bible while we do this. It'll be in the context of history, in context geography, in the times of layers. You know, I'll tell you this in a minute, but we have dimensions, north and south, east and west, high and low, right, plus time. So these events happen in places, but they also happen in time. So on our lesson today, we're going to talk about Joppa and Tel Aviv. And Joppa is a place that I don't know how it started out, but I know one of our trips, I said, why don't we go to Joppa? It wasn't on the itinerary. And, of course, the guide, the recipe is the gospel. It's not on it. We're not going. Okay. Well, can you take me around the loop where it goes? Well, all right. So, in fact, that's one of the pictures I have here. We drove around the loop. And then next time it came back, and I programmed it into our lesson, our place to stop. And now, to me, it's a got-to-go-to place because all the stacks of stuff that happened at Joppa, or Jaffa, as you well know, is close to Tel Aviv. So we're going to spend our whole evening around that area as we talk about the Bible lands. When I talk about the Bible lands, I'm going to include Jordan. I'm going to include Egypt. You could include Turkey, Asia Minor, but that's not going to be part of this study. So we're not going to probably get into all some of those things till quite a bit later. So what I'll have then is a relatively thorough study of all the Bible lands on some kind of presentation. And in the meantime, I'll learn a lot more about it than I did before. So. All right, let me see. Last week, I listened to my lesson after you endure it. I have to go home and endure it. And there's quite a few times when I say things that are opposite of what I mean to say. When I mean north, I mean south. And I noticed that last week I said, among other things that were not quite right, that the mountain ranges in the north, up, go north and south. Did anybody notice that? No. They go east and west. That's right. So when I do something stupid like that, just say, north and south is not right, you know. So anyway. So I wanted to correct that. In the south, the mountain ranges go north and south. In fact, there's only one mountain range, and there's one on the Jordan side. But in the north, in Galilee, we have them go, by Nazareth, they go east and west. All right. So I feel better now. There was other mistakes, but I don't want to mention them, so we'll just go on. All right, here's a picture. I just put you in the middle of it. I hope that you will kind of consider yourself on this tour of the lands. You'll get a lot more in this tour than you do if you go, because we just have more time. Well, that may not be true. We have more time to study, I think, these subjects, although we only have an hour every week, so and then maybe we do spend more time on the road. So this is a group in 2011, so... nothing special about that group, but some of you are in it, I'm sure. So consider yourself part of the group as we head out from the Ben-Gurion Airport. Just a little reminder, our study of the land is a multidimensional study. I just mentioned that to you. We're interested in the places located by coordinates, GPS coordinates, north and south, east and west. And then we have the third dimension of up and down. We have the Dead Sea below sea level, and we have Mount Hermon at 9,000 feet above sea level, so we have these great variation changes, and we talk about going up to Jerusalem as a direction that is actually up to Jerusalem, and it is not the high point, but it is on a high point. But we also want to remind ourselves that we are dealing with time, because you go in one place and many things happen at one place. It depends on the time scale you're in, the block you're in. So none of this is unusual for any place in the world, because it's not special for this land, but it's especially important for us to grasp the order of things when we think about what happened in the Bible. We believe in progressive revelation. In other words, we expect that God has, we know that God has revealed more things later. We'll know more things later than they did earlier. So those become an issue, too, about the time aspect of it. We believe in progressive revelation. That is, God reveals more truth as time passes. That gives us the chronology. The when is an essential part of our study. And so, therefore, dates are important. And I know everybody says, I cannot remember dates. I don't know how to tell you to remember dates. But if you really wanted to, guess what? You would know the dates. Now, you can't know them all at once. You got to kind of start with your birthday. That's a good place to start. And then you go to the wedding, you know, and then maybe your parents' birth dates. And, you know, you go through the list of dates and you start building on it. And then pretty soon your mind works into a little a system where you learn dates built on something that works for you, and all of a sudden you remember that, you know, the Independence Day for the United States, 76, you know, next time you learn another date. Anyway, dates are important, and we're going to talk about dates, not a lot, but we want to make sure that we understand the date we're in, because that'll tell us the layer we're in. This whole idea of when is not a new concept to be understood in history. And when also affects somewhat the geography. So the legal question of what did he know and when did he know it becomes a formula for assigning guilt or innocence. So in the Bible, we have notable times when God has acted. When did he act and when didn't he act? This factors importantly into the geography, the place, the time, the history, and by revelation, what God's purpose is. Last week we talked about this map that I found late in my study, but I like it, so I use it again. Color-coded. It shows the mountain ranges and the valleys. So we have the wilderness of Judea. Now, this might work. You see my arrow? All right, so we have the wilderness of Judea on the backside, the east side of this mountain range. Then we have the plains along the west side. We have the Shephelah Range. This is where we're going to be today. Here's Joppa, the Shephelah Range. And then we have the plain of Sharon, or the Sharon is up here. And we know that there is a rose of Sharon, but it's really not a rose as we think of it, the flower. We have Judea is down here, which is where Jerusalem is. We have Galilee, Lower Galilee. And then we have the Upper Galilee. And we have water bodies, the Upper Jordan, the Sea of Galilee, which is really not a sea, it's a lake. Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea, and that's where it dead ends. Then we have on the Transjordan. Now we have Transjordan to the west, too, so you got to know a little bit who's speaking and what we're talking about. Transjordan from Israel's side, it would be to the east, would be Jordan. Gilead, remember we had the acronym GAME, G-A-M-E, are the territories. Gilead is kind of stretched. It really slots, as they show it here, it slides really down further south, but Gilead is considered up here. Then we have the Yarmouk River, the Jacob River, the Ammon territory, the Arnon River, and Moab, and then the Zered River, and the Edom River, Edomites down here. So those are the basic areas that we talked about, and somehow, it would be nice for you to know where all those were as you read your Bible. Okay, man-made features. In our pictorial tour of the land, we must be aware that whatever we look at, wherever you stand, you are on the top layer, by definition, of that place. It's like layering layering of sedimentary rock formation. In fact, this is how the archaeologists do their research. The top is the most recent. The lower layers are the history. The record thus must be chronological, and it's almost like you can take to the bank. What's lower is older than what's on top. Unless you don't believe in the flood, then they make these slide. These can slide over each other. Unbelievable. Okay, As time passes, the work of weather, the movement of the unstable Earth's crust and volcanoes, earthquakes, landslides, river channels moving, wind and water erosion, all affect the surface of the Earth, thus, plus the work of man, changes some of the features. Now, what we know is like the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal changes the geography in a sense because the routes are shortened because they've cut across land, but these are man-made things, and what you have in the background of this picture is the Aswan Dam in Egypt, and it is set up there for irrigation and electrical power. So these things change the geography, and some of these things are man-made. But most of the geography has not changed, and that's the thrill of being in Israel. You could stand here and look at Arbel here and say, you know, that is pretty much the way it looked when Jesus was there. And the valley that you have, see if this works, the valley that you have that goes to Nazareth is right there. And it goes off to the left, which would be south. And like I say, it's just exactly how it was. The lake is there. The elevation of it, level of it might be a little bit different. So most of the geography has not changed perceptibly. We point out some of these features as still their features. And I might say Mount Arbel's lofty peak was there when Jesus was in Galilee, and it is an anchor point to locate yourself in the region when you're there. You always can look up. If you within around the sea, you look where that point is, you always know that's on the west side. And you do get mixed up sometimes where you are. And it may seem kind of simple, but that is an unusual feature that you cannot miss. This picture is taken from the kibbutz Nof Gennesor, where the Jesus boat is. It's probably taken off the dock. There's a dock that sticks out into the water, and our next plan is we're going to stay at that for our night at the kibbutz rather than be in the town of Tiberias. We'll see how that works out. Now, the dying Dead Sea, this is kind of finishing up from last week yet. The dying Dead Sea drops at about 3 foot a year. The Sea of Galilee was higher at one time. That would be different. The Jordan River was fuller at one time. The Dead Sea was deeper, higher, shore. The shoreline was where the modern-day road is. And I've got a picture of the level of the water, and it's above the where the road is, where the bus drives. There's a mark on it. And say it has dropped, I think I say, somewhere about 150 feet. That's a lot of water drop. At 3 feet a year, you can figure out that's about 50 years, and that's kind of what they're thinking is the drop of the water. So most of the features talked about in the Bible, even many, if not most of the cities and some of the villages are located in the land even today. So that reality, that's the word, grips the visitor to the land that Abraham, Moses, David, Jesus, and Paul saw these things visible to us today. So visiting the geographical sites become a priority for me. You know, they have built churches on a lot of these spots, and where they haven't built a church, it's kind of nice to see the shoreline where there's not a church. However, the church does mark a spot, and if there's a church on it, it becomes somewhat protected spot, and it doesn't get destroyed with a Holiday Inn sitting on it. So there are some advantages to have churches built on it. We don't badmouth the Catholics all the time for everything to do, but building a church sometimes do help to anchor these locations. And then, of course, there are places that man has left his mark, as I've already talked about, his aqueducts, his cities, the tombs, and so forth. Last week, I talked a little bit about this draining of water out of the Gulf of Aqaba over the ridge and into the Dead Sea, and having a hydroelectric plant, also taking water to desalinize it for Jordan as well as Israel. Can you see that? It's kind of on the bottom. Anyway, I just thought to give you a little picture of how that is. These other pictures show the recessing, what's the word for water? Runoff? That's not the right word. But you see these things that fall into sinkholes, like this dock here. But see where the water's way down here? And here's 1985. We were there first time in Israel. We were in 1983. So the water was up to here when we were there. And this is about where we were. I mean, this is kind of in Getty. And when we went, probably 94, we had the bathing bathhouse where you got dressed was a quarter mile away. And they put you on a shuttle. And you drove on a shuttle to the water. I mean, it used to be right next to the water. So it's really sad to see that happen. And I figured, is this anything to do with when the Lord's going to come? You know, like before the Dead Sea goes dry, or, you know, I don't know. Just who knows? So there we have Mount Arbel, and my favorite place is to be up here and look down. So anyway. Here are the Great Waterway, sometimes called the Aqueduct. The seat of the Roman government, by the way, we're going to do this next week. The seat of the Roman government is at Caesarea Maritima, not to be confused with Caesarea Philippi. Philippi is way up north. This is Caesarea Caesar, named after the Caesar. Both towns named after Caesar. This is the Maritime, so it's along the water, Maritima. So in order for it to function, that is this Caesarea Maritima, which is the headquarters for the Romans, in order for it to function, Herod brought water from the Shuni spring about 10 miles to the north and to the east. Pilate is ruling from here. We know he was in Jerusalem when he tried Christ, but he was there because of the Passover. It was not where he ruled from. He was the kind of guy that had to be with action, was to keep it under control. The Passover was a difficult time, so he was in Jerusalem during that time. He didn't live there. He lived here at Caesarea Maritima. We'll, again, visit that next week. We'll visit that more next week. Okay. All right, so here we can figure that man just figures into these features that are still standing even over 2,000 years old. So the entrance, or the port into the land, as we arrive in the land, we pass through the border control of Israel at the Ben-Gurion Airport, which is at near Tel Aviv. Sometime the name is given as Lod, L-O-D, the Bible name, or sometimes, and I don't know how you'd say, the Lida or Lida, is given as this place as well. And when you come to this part of your journey, I always kind of sigh of relief, because we are on firm ground and we made it to the visitor center. So we're on land here. The year of 2008, we landed, and that was when George Bush was visiting, and his airplane got in just before we did, and I thought, oh no, we're going to be stuck in the air in a holding pattern while the president is visiting Israel. We'll never get on the ground. But as it worked out, we were not delayed at all. But when we got on the ground, we looked out, and there was Air Force One. And we saw later on the news coverage of Olmert and our president talking together. They were on television and so forth, and they spoke our language most of the time, at least the Bushes did. So anyway, that was kind of a neat thing to be there when he was there. So the port of entry is close to the ancient port entry of Joppa or Jaffa. I'm probably going to say Joppa. I don't know why. Jaffa is the name they use today. It is fitting that the traditional port of international entry into the land remains nearly at the same place. So here's a spot I got as close to Jaffa I got that year. And yes, this is my picture because you can see the reflection in the windows. But that's all I've got. And you see the Mediterranean Sea out further. So we're at Jaffa, one of the great shots, because you're looking north towards Tel Aviv. And we start working on our layers of history here. So we come to our first example of multi-layered historical place, the city of Joppa. I just mentioned here in the front, Napoleon's cannons are gone. Later on, I'll show you a picture that Napoleon was here, by the way, in 1799. And the cannons were here, and I thought, well, maybe they took the cannons away because they might have thought somebody might load them. Or maybe they needed the brass. I don't know. Maybe they got robbed. But you see Tel Aviv at a distance, a very beautiful city. Whoop, don't do that. Do this. So we're now in Joppa. Say quite a bit about Joppa, except that it was not an attractive place over the modern days. It was not an attractive place. It has been cleaned up since the Jews control it now. It has become, since it's not a very attractive place, but kind of cleaned up, it doesn't have status. So it is a place where artists collect, you know, cheap rent, draw your pictures for nothing and whatever. So it's kind of become a place like that. And it's not an industrial center. It's not really a tourist center. It's just kind of a place. But we go there because of the history that's there. So we look out toward the west here. It steps down to the harbor. The port was used to bring trade materials in and out of the land. That's why we're studying this, because of the significance it is to the land. And the Mediterranean we see at a distance. And the water is always wonderful. And this was not pointed out to me, but we do have what looks to me like what's left of a harbor. And this, the harbor at Jaffa is not a very, very good natural harbor. You usually think of a natural harbor as, land enclosed, at least half moon or something like that, which would be what breakwaters. So these breakwaters probably had to be made, and that's what you see here. And there is a little abutment or jutment of the land out onto the Mediterranean Sea, and that's probably why it became a port. The other port that you see along the Mediterranean Sea is at Haifa, and that's the main port for Israel today, because you don't see the big ships lining up here unloading, but you do see that at Haifa, not here. So to some extent, Joppa has ceased to be the port of entry, for that kind of thing. Again, we have a breakwater and then smaller boats out there, and the day we were there, it was horribly windy. You can see the white caps on the Mediterranean Sea, and the wind in Israel is no more comfortable than the wind in Nebraska. It doesn't really make much difference. In fact, it's more of a nuisance there because you wish it wasn't there. There are cannons sitting. So Jaffa is part of the tribe of Dan. Later we'll see the major settlement in the north. Dan wasn't happy with what they got. So in the regular Bible maps, we see Dan down here. Anyway, here's Dan, and I'll tell you a little bit about that a little bit here. But see, here's Joppa. So Joppa isn't Dan, and Tel Aviv is going to be right up here. Tel Aviv doesn't exist here. And so here's Benjamin, and right on the shore, right on the border of Benjamin and Jerusalem. Here we are. Here's Benjamin and Simeon, the north, south. I'm sorry. We have Jerusalem. All right. So then we have, I can use this. We have this road that goes from Jerusalem to Joppa. That's a very common travel road, and I'll show you more about that today. All right, so I want just to mention to you Dan here. Not all of them left Dan here. Some of them went north, and of course they got into corrupt worship because they were so far from Jerusalem that they hired their own priests. You remember how this goes, and they started to have calf worship up there, and it's corrupted northern tribes. Anyway, Dan was the guilty tribe. So Danites did not like the apportioned land, took it upon themselves to move north, so far north that they felt it necessary to have their own worship system. Later it will be the place of calf worship again later in our visit, and we will do that. So the use of the Joppa Harbor, we have Solomon and King Hiram from Lebanon. Joppa, the seaport for Jerusalem. Well, we're looking at the first, Joshua was the first one, because Joshua apportioned out the land to Dan. So did I have Joshua up there at 1400 B.C.? Yeah, the next one now is Solomon, about 1000 B.C., maybe just a little bit later. Joppa is the seaport city serving Jerusalem. During the construction of the temple, Solomon arranged for the cedar timbers to come by sea from Lebanon. 2 Chronicles 2:16 tells us that. Joppa was the port through which the building materials were brought to the land, the international port city of the land. And here we have beautiful Lebanon. Some of you guys remember his dad was a doctor. He was from Lebanon. And if you ever seen pictures of Lebanon of a few years ago, it is a very, very beautiful, beautiful country. Anything along the Mediterranean coast, at least on the east side, is a beautiful, beautiful place. So here we have the Lebanese flag. In the middle of this flag, we have the cedar of Lebanon as part of their flag configuration. So Hiram, king of Tyre, see here's Tyre, here's Israel, just a little above, answered with a letter. I don't want to read all this to you because it takes time, and I will not have time for all this, but he's going to build this house, and he commends Solomon for doing this, and to the bottom in the green he said, who will build a house for the Lord and a royal palace for himself? So Hiram is on board with this, and he says to them, we will cut whatever, after he agrees that they're going to trade other things for this wood, we will cut whatever timber you need from Lebanon to bring it to you on rafts by sea to Joppa so that you may carry it up to Jerusalem. Now, I understand that there was a river even from the Mediterranean to some distance up east towards Jerusalem. Now, it can't go very far because it goes up pretty fast. So anyway, that they would have floated it as far as they could because that's easier than hauling it any other way. Then we have, again, next notch up, Ezra. This is now the second temple after the Babylon captivity around 520. It was finished in 515. Around 520, let's say, the same timber supply, again, for rebuilding of the temple in Ezra's day, which is after the Babylon captivity. Cedar wood came from Lebanon, courtesy of Cyrus the Great, the Persian king, who blessed Israel and funded their return to the land after 70-year Babylonian captivity. Again, the port of Jaffa was used, Ezra 3:7. And there it says, bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the sea at Joppa. Again, this is King Cyrus the Great. Well, I don't know which trip this was. Well, yeah, I bought them 2008. We were taking a tour of the Knesset, and I wasn't at all very excited about going to the governmental center because it's not biblical in a sense. But they did show us one of the trees of these, one of these Lebanese trees, the cedars of Lebanon. And I said, wow, that is a beautiful tree. Look how straight it grows. Now, in the place where it grows, it probably grows better than other places because there's nothing competing with it. So it has this absolutely straight and probably been trimmed tree. All right, but you still see it's a very, very beautiful tree. And I looked to see what is different about the tree, and you probably had different ways of discovering this, but one of the horticulturists showed how the needles grow. They grow in clumps rather than along a spine. Although I did look it up in another way, and they showed just like a normal evergreen tree. So I'm going to buy this guy's story because it makes more sense because he seems to know what he's talking about. So we have these pine needles in clumps, and that sort of makes this an unusual tree. So this is on the governmental grounds of the Knesset in Jerusalem. The tree almost went extinct, and you can almost imagine why, with the Turks cutting down every tree they could see. Never planted one because it might offend Allah. So they stripped all the land, and so the trees went with that, and you cut all the trees down. Finally, they're all gone, but they now reconstituted, and I don't think they're extinct anymore. So the nearly extinct tree is desirable for quality construction explains the near extinction. Notice the compounding of the needles. I mentioned that to you. The tree is a gift from Lebanon to Israel, and I might add here, at better times. I don't think they'd send a tree down to Israel today. So you see that tree has been there for probably 40, 50, 60, 50 years probably since they're coming as a nation. So it's a stately tree with straight trunks, and that's always good when you're building. These are ruins at Joppa that I don't know what they're from. I just remember they were ancient ruins, and seemed to me like go back to Egyptian times. So we just mentioned to you that there are ruins that have not been excavated or made anything out of. Maybe someday somebody will. And of course, funding is always a big problem. So Joppa becomes an important city of commerce and connection with the international world, like Egypt, and later on to Europe and even Spain. Speaking of Spain, we have Jonah, the runaway, not the slave, just a runaway. But Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish, which is Spain, from the presence of the Lord. So he went down to Joppa, found his ship, which is going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. So he was at Joppa, the place where you go when you're going to go out international. So it is noteworthy that so many have ridiculed the account of Jonah and the unbelievable whale, but when it comes to making the most of it for tourism, the whale shows up in the realities of the Bible, even though it is a bit romanticized here. But as Bible lovers, we love the reminder that there was a Jonah, and he left the land from here. So we're told that. And now we jump forward quite a few years to the new, not the new age, but the new church, to the church age. And in Acts, we find Joppa mentioned more than once. In fact, there's chapters 9 through 11 deal with things around Joppa. And by the way, Joppa to Caesarea Maritima, which is a little further north, these interact with Peter. But before we do Peter, we find that Dorcas is here. Dorcas is also called Tabitha. Now in Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha. This is Acts 9:36. Translated, it's called Dorcas. This woman was abounding with deeds and kindness and charity, and which she continually did, and she died. And I read the whole text for you. So she's a dead person, and here's Peter now. And Peter was sent, but Peter sent them all out. He's called in and knelt down and prayed and turned to the body and said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. So we have a resurrection here, a resuscitation here. And it became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And Peter stayed many days in Joppa with the tanner named Simon. And of course, we have a church built somewhere in the neighborhood called St. Peter's Church, and we have the either mural or it's a mosaic, I'm not sure which it is, in the church of Peter doing the miracle. And now that introduces us, Peter, into the picture here. Peter is staying in the home of Simon the Tanner, the worker of leather. Peter has come here after the ascension of Jesus, keep the time pretty soon, not very long. He continues to preach the gospel to the Jewish people. Another person, a Gentile, Cornelius, an Italian soldier, a God-fearer, which means a believed in the God of Israel, was at Caesarea Maritima, which is up the road. We're going to be there next week. He is told of a vision to ask Peter to come to Joppa to come to him. So Peter should go from Joppa up to Caesarea. At this time, Peter sees a vision, coincidentally, on the roof of the house of Simon about associating or joining clean and unclean animals in a sheet, which is understood to be prohibited by law, Jewish law. So in this vision, all the animals are equal, indicating that the Gentiles are on the same footing with the Jews in the church. So Peter is selected to make this experience, or have this experience, is selected because he is the leader in the church. Seeing a vision to authorize the change of policy, thus by Peter, the authority in the early church, he opens the door to the international church community at the international harbor at Joppa. And I think it's kind of interesting that it happened there, because from this point, in a sense, the whole world is reached. Now, I know that Paul didn't leave from Joppa to go to Europe, but this becomes the portal to the world, and I think that the figure is kind of nice to think about it that way. These other pictures we have, this St. Peter's Church is up here on a hill, of course, Mediterranean Sea, and the drawing of the visions, and I've got my campaign against angels that have wings, so don't disregard the wings. And this is the door of Simon Peter. I'm sure it's fictitious, but, you know, it's in the vicinity. Again, here is the Church of St. Peter. So we're not concerned that this might not be the home of Simon. We're not too worried about that. It's probably not. So we accept the gesture, knowing that we are at least in the proximity where he lived. Now, we stood outside with one of our guides, Yanif, and he says, I can't go down there. I can't knock on the door and ask if we'd come in because I'm a Jew. The person that's inside won't let Jews into the house. But if you were German, you could come in. So it's interesting that here in Joppa, the doors were open to the Gentiles. The doors are closed again to the Jews. Anyway, interesting. So Joppa was an Arab town where Jews were not very welcome. This is kind of modern day. We were told that a Jewish guide would not be welcome in this house of Simon, so we didn't knock on the door. Now, Napoleon slept here, and so we have a historic site. And if you remember anything about Napoleon's campaign, he went from Europe, followed along the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, Tyre, got kind of trapped there, Sidon, went down to Cairo, and then he came back. Never went into Jerusalem. He had enough respect for the Jews and for the city that he didn't do anything with Jerusalem, but he did stay here. It says here. It says right there he slept here. So we know about Napoleon. Now we have the clock tower, which is a modern-day landmark that shows up on a lot of pictures. The Jaffa clock tower is one of the seven clock towers built in Palestine during the Ottoman period. I think that's the only constructive thing they did. We talked about that before class. The Ottoman just didn't do anything. The others are located at Safed, which is in northern Israel, next to the, you know, where the Jews went when they got kicked out of Jerusalem. This is where their intellectuals went, the strict Jews. Acre is along the shore of the Mediterranean. We have Nazareth. We know where that is. Haifa is the Mount Carmel range. Nablus is now on the ridge north before you get to the Sea of Valley Megiddo. And Jerusalem, the last being the only one that has survived until today, which is what you see here. It's kind of a beautiful tower. The tower was built to commemorate the silver jubilee of the reign of Ottoman Sultan, and so on and so forth. So it's really not significant, except it does mark the downtown area of Jaffa. Now, if you were, and I'm sure all of you were, with us when we did the riots in the land after the British Mandate started in Jaffa. Jaffa and Jerusalem, I'm not sure which one was first, but they were almost the same time. And you see the tower in the back, I think that's the same tower. So the Jaffa riots, this is exactly out of the lesson. I'll repeat this for you. The Jaffa riots was a series of violent riots in mandatory Palestine, mandatory British, mandatory Palestine. British were overseeing the work in Palestine, May 1921, which began as a fight between two Jewish groups. In fact, one of the groups was a communist group. Remember that? Maybe you don't remember that. The Jews, when the communists were, didn't want communists, and some of the communists wanted to force their ideology on the other Jews. So they had this fight. And as they fought each other, the Arabs started attacking both of them. So it was kind of different than what they expected. So the rioting began in Jaffa and spread to other parts of the country. The riots resulted in death of 47 Jews, 48 Arabs, and so on and so forth. So, in fact, so bad, General Allenby, the British general, who conquered Jerusalem, sent two destroyers to Jaffa and to Haifa to quell the riots. Samuel, the high commander, British high commander, a Jewish guy, assented to, and two or three of the small groups holding 300 Jews who were refugees refused permission to land and were forced to return to Istanbul. And at the same time, Ali Husseini and his nephew, who has became the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, that was so bad for all the Jews and for the area, became the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. So the riots just continued. Again, you have kind of a tragic thing happen here at Jaffa. Now, Easton Bible Dictionary says this. I don't know what date it's written. It's not yesterday. It's a little older reading. It bears Jaffa, bears the modern name of Jaffa, and exhibits all the decrepitude, all the decrepitude of, and squalor of cities ruled over by the Turks. See, I'm not so hard on them. Scarcely any other town has been so often overrun, sacked, pillaged, burned, and rebuilt. Its present population is said to be about 16,000. It was taken by the French under Napoleon in 1799, who gave orders for the massacre here of 4,000 prisoners. It is connected with Jerusalem by the only carriage route that exists in the country, and also by a railroad completed in 1892. It ran about 100 years. Jaffa is noticed a monument from 1600 BC to 1300 BC. It was attacked by Assyrian Sennacherib in 702. So it's got a history. Not a good one. A lot of port cities don't. Okay, so here you have the modern map. Jaffa, here's Jerusalem. And this is Highway 1, which is you drive on if you're going to go to the airport. So here's the airport. Can you see what I'm doing? You can see my arrow? Tell me you can see my arrow. Hey, it got big there for a minute. What did it do? All right, so we're about 50 miles, something like that. And I mentioned, I showed you the city with its gates. And the Jaffa Gate faces what? Jaffa, right. Faces west. So you look at all of the gates, they're named, not all the names, but the names that have locations on them are facing, like the Damascus Gates faces north, because that's where Damascus is. So you have the Zion Gate down here. You've got the Dung Gate over here, the Sheep Gate over here, the Lion Gate over here. But anyway, these are named after cities, and so you always know what direction you are, where those are. And I'm totally turned around. So it really helps me to know that's Jaffa Gate, so that means Jaffa's that way. That's what we have here. And we mentioned before that they're part of Dan. And what else can I say? It says here there's hour and 44 minutes. That is if you're going to take the bus. It's going to take less time if you're going to drive it. Okay, now, transportation. Jaffa to Jerusalem. You got to be there to see this. Under construction is a high-speed railroad from Tel Aviv Airport to Jerusalem, costing $2 billion. The construction schedule started in 2001, will be completed in 2018. We're going to miss it. The length is about 56 kilometers, 34 miles. Speed up to 96 miles. The design speed is 96 miles per hour. It takes about 26 minutes rather than 1 hour on Highway 1 if there's no traffic. And it's, the you know, since the land is so roly-poly in the mountains, we go up to Jerusalem, we go from zero elevation at the Mediterranean, close to the Mediterranean, to 2,400 at Jerusalem, so we have a lot of elevation change here. So you're either making a tunnel through a mountain or you're building a bridge over a valley. It just seems like, you know, you don't have anything on flat roads. And the high-speed, you know, you can't be doing this a lot, so you'd be, you know, be in the bathroom chucking up. So So they put it pretty level because of the high speed. Enough said. So I think from what I can tell, this is that road that's finished with the road with the train on it. It's, I don't know if it's running. It's not running very much of the time, much of it. And here's our locomotive from Joppa to Jerusalem. It did run until 1980 approximately. The roadbed got so bad they didn't fix it, so they're doing this. And again, here you have your line that's going to be built. Just talk about railroads. They also have light railroad in Jerusalem, which a lot of controversy over that. And it's a joy to ride. We have done that. And for $8, it takes you somewhere, wherever you want to go. Now, this is the, if I can say the word, Mavrasert Valley. And you see where this is going to go. Hey, maybe I can do this for you. The roadway is going to be up here, right? And then it's going to die off into a tunnel. This has nothing to do with the Bible. But it's interesting what the Jews have done in their land. And you go in and see this and say, these people are not going anywhere. There's no one's packing their bags. They're putting roots down here. And they'll tell you that. So the only way that they're going to, if they're going to be inconvenience, it's going to be attacked, but they're not going to run anywhere, so some would die. I don't think the Bible teaches that. I think they're going to be preserved, at least until the tribulation. So anyway, yes. You're looking with Jerusalem to the right. It's coming from Jerusalem to the right, and it's going towards Jaffa on the left, which is pretty much west. You're looking pretty much west. And they got some tremendous... I love bridge building. I love cranes. And I said, wow, these traveling cranes, how they build these things, and they build them, cantilever, push them out like that, and then they pull them back. It's just amazing. So this is on that same road. I was just hoping they'd be done by the time we get there next time, but they're not. So either we're tunneling or we're making the bridge. $2 billion in a small country. So we transition to Tel Aviv. I can't tell what slide number I'm on, so... who cares? The place of the cranes. We go out looking at the cranes. Where's Larry? These are the kind that make you some money. The secular international city. The nation has 8.5 million people as of 2016. Tel Aviv at 400,000. That seems to me a lot bigger than that. But they also talk about there's an environment that has a third of the people in Israel live in this environment more than Tel Aviv. Jerusalem has 800,000, so we're talking Tel Aviv is similar to Omaha, and Jerusalem, you know, not twice, but almost twice as much. But then they're a lot more dense than what we live. You know, we have to have our space, you know, the patio and the room for the cat. But they live very, very condensed and very expensively. They live wherever they live. View out of our hotel in 2008, couldn't help but take that, and I noticed all the cranes that were sitting in the horizon is rebuilding these buildings in Tel Aviv. So Tel Aviv, having made the case for all places having layers of lasting centuries or even millenniums, we must now look at an exception. The exception is the modern city of Tel Aviv, founded in 1909, leaving Jaffa. People leaving Jaffa, they can't stand living there anymore. I'm sure there was oppression there because of the Muslims that were living there. So it is called Tel, which is a place of a dead city, the Tel, a mound or a destructed city is a Tel. The name Aviv means to be alive again, so we have a city that rose from the dead. In 1909, a number of Jewish residents decided to move to a healthier environment outside the crowded and dusty, noisy city of Jaffa. They established on 12 acres of sand dunes north of Jaffa. In 1910, the suburb was named Tel Aviv after Nathan Sokolow, translations of Altneutland, which is Herzl, Theodor Herzl, remember him? Fictional depiction of the Jewish state. So, you know, they kind of building off of a story. But anyway, is it intentional or what? Tel Aviv and Ezekiel's message. Whether intentional or not, the city's name has overtones of Ezekiel 37. Where Israel is seen as a valley of dry bones, which are obviously dead, but will be raised again from the dead. Hence, Tel Aviv. Life from the dead. Israel, the nation, and the people will be raised to life before the kingdom is inaugurated. How else to say it? They don't get saved before the tribulation. Actually, get saved before the kingdom comes. So today, Tel Aviv is the heart of the conurbanian urbation. That's a new word, conurbation, which I guess is a lot of city area, known as the Gush Dan. Dan, remember our tribe, in which one-third of the country's population lives. 2.8 million live in this area. And if you drive from Tel Aviv up along the coast north to Caesarea up to the Haifa, it's just about all one continuous city, especially on the shore side. Now, the boat you see here brought illegal Jews to the shore of the land during the British Mandate. Remember, I showed you at Joppa, they were returning boats back. Well, these are the boats that they turned back, kind of boats, maybe not that one. A continued reminder of the price the Jews have paid to be in the land. And talk about our Joppa reference. Now, May 14, 1948, in Tel Aviv, at 4 o'clock that afternoon, meanwhile, in the Little Art Museum of Rothschild on Rothschild Boulevard, in Tel Aviv, David Ben-Gurion, white-haired 60-year-old leader of the Jewish National Council, rose to speak. Born in Poland, Ben-Gurion had immigrated to Palestine as a young man in 1906, fought against the Turks in the British Army in the First World War, and enjoyed a successful career as a trade union organizer and politician. Now he announced the formation of the State of Israel, the first independent Jewish state in 19th century, and I might correct him for 500 years. I got to go clear back to Nebuchadnezzar by reading out a proclamation. He says, by virtue of the natural and historic right of the Jewish people and by resolution of the General Assembly of the United Nations, we hereby proclaim the establishment of the Jewish state of Palestine to be called Israel. The proclamation took 20 minutes to read out to an audience of some 200 people. It was also broadcast to the New Voice of Israel radio station in Tel Aviv. The Zionist anthem, Hatkavah, Hope, was sung, and at just after 4:30 p.m., Ben-Gurion said, the state of Israel has arisen. This meeting is ended. In his private diary, he wrote, I am filled with foreboding. So it was not an easy birth, and he knew what was ahead. I won't read that again. So we have the picture in this museum. We are planning to make a stop at that this trip. I've never been there, so we'd like to stop there if we can. All right, now the unending war with Israel. The War of Independence, May 1948-1949, followed that proclamation of state. On the left, you see five nations attack Israel: Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria. The blue line that's marked out here in the middle panel shows the front, basically, because the land behind the line to the Mediterranean Sea was partitioned for the Jews. But when they attacked, they started to push back. These are belligerents now attacking Israel. And with the rules of war, if the belligerent attacks, the attack can push back and the land that they conquer becomes theirs. So by March 1949, there's an armistice, and we have the Hiroshima raising of the flag in Israel rather than American in Hiroshima after World War II. So the gains by Israel in the War of Independence were 50% more land than was promised them. Now, we got to include here the Sinai Peninsula, which they took. The Arabs were losing badly, called for a ceasefire, which is what you do when you're losing. The Israelis held the land by international law they had gained from the belligerency. So the pink, or orange is the white color, orange is what they gained in this short nine-month war. Actually, it was probably about a three-month war. All right, so just a little bit of history if you weren't in our lesson. That's how we got to our modern state. And then they have the 67 war and the 73 war, which took in all the land that's on the west side of the Jordan River, is now under Israel's control. So we have this wonderful map again of the trails routes. Jaffa is the port city for the land. It continues to be the international connection to the outside world. Now we're going to say Jaffa before, now it's the airport at Lod, just a few miles away. still the main entry into the land. So the location remains at Joppa, or Jaffa, Tel Aviv, the Ben-Gurion Airport. The transportation was via their ancient road, carriage road, to Jerusalem. Now it's highway number one. The old steam railroad system to Jerusalem pumped away from about 1880-something till now 1980. I mentioned that to you, about 100 years. The city of Tel Aviv is the diplomatic center of the nation. I don't think there are any diplomatic centers in Jerusalem. They have consulates there, but embassies. Thank you. So while Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, no embassies have offices there. A contentious issue with the Arabs. Now, remember, I don't even remember which of our candidates says, when I'm going to be president, I'm going to move the capital to Jerusalem. Somebody hear that? Well, it'll be a little fight if that happens. I'm all for it. So we have the new high-speed rail system will be functioning in 2 years, connecting the outside world with Jerusalem via Ben-Gurion Airport. Beside these modern-day activities, we know of Joppa from the days of Joshua, who gave the land to the tribe of Dan, and we have just observed the multi-layered place. So we have seen the Chapellan Plains over here. Next week, we'll move along the shore. We'll run through the Plain of Sharon, run by the Silicon City of Israel, where the iPhone was made, and other things are, it's their intellectual developing city area, moving on to the Caesarea the Maritima on the Mediterranean Sea. So we have a picture of the Herodian Aqueduct. We'll talk about that next week. That is it.